blue.
Yes, yeah. Of course. Ready and action. Hey, everybody, welcome to a brand new MMA Roasted podcast. It's me, Adam Hunter. I'm your host. We have a very, very special guest. Two special guests today in studio.
No. Only I am not that special today, trust me. I rode the short bus, but trust me, we got a real special here today.
You are extremely special, Josh. You are a former UFC champion, two-time. How many people can actually say that? Actually, someone else here can say that. Mark Kerr is here, the legendary Mark Kerr. I mean, this is like, I am so honored to have both you guys here. I mean, the first time I've ever watched mixed martial arts was watching The Smashing Machine.
Oh, right.
That was my, and now I was hooked after that.
Yeah.
And that was about you and your life and what you were doing. And how's everything going, man?
Everything's going good. Just living life, and I have a great 12-year-old son, and that usually occupies most of my time.
Nice.
Trying to keep him in football, baseball, or golf. But
you don't have him wrestling?
No, he's actually starting to show interest in it now. So he's actually enrolled in, it's called Fight Ready back in Arizona, which is kind of like a parlay. So they have a little bit of jiu-jitsu, a little bit of boxing, a little bit of wrestling, see what it gravitates to.
Now, you're living in Arizona.
Yep.
Now, I mean, you are a guy, I actually watched The Smashing Machine again last night. And that was the first time I watched it in, I've been 20 years.
Yeah.
And I was like, holy shit. It was still one of the most raw documentaries. I mean, how did that change your life, that documentary?
I think in a couple ways that it crossed over to, I think it was the first real MMA that crossed over to mainstream media, and I think that was the one where it exposed MMA to a totally different genre of people. That was one. And then from that point, it was for me to look at it and watch it and see the raw reflection of what I was hard. So from where I was then and where I am now, I'm thankful.
I mean, to where you were, I mean, you were you came on the fighting scene. We were talking before. I mean, you were a state champ wrestler, mm-hmm. from Ohio.
Yep.
Ohio State. You started in Iowa.
Yeah.
You and Pat Miletich were teammates.
Yeah, I actually went to high school with him at Bettendorf High School.
Wow, in the Quad Cities?
Yeah, yeah. It's strange how that little tidbit, it feels like a Kevin Bacon kind of,
sure.
relation. So it's just one of those where Pat was, I think at the time, Pat was like a junior or senior, and it was my first year of wrestling, and Bettendorf was coming off, I think, their second or third state championship, so it was a room full of studs. And so Pat used to throw me around.
Just, really?
Yeah.
I mean, so you were the freshman. Was he cool to you, or was he kind of...
Actually, Pat was, believe it or not, he's one of the cooler guys, because, you look at a freshman in high school coming in, not knowing anybody, and he's actually one of the cooler guys. He really was.
Yeah, and I was a freshman. We got hazed. Even in college, wrestling was the worst. We had to shave all our heads.
I did not get hazed coming in as a wrestler, but everybody kind of thought like, whatever, this big old goofy pile, like, ha, ha, ha. And then I started winning all the matches. And then I was the only guy on the team, like, winning everything. And then they're just like, well, fuck you, you're big. And I'm like, what the hell, man?
That usually is the default for hazing, is that if you're over a heavyweight or a 90-pounder, you kind of get away with nothing.
Yeah, no one's picking on the big guys.
But then I just eat in front of them when I got to cut weight.
Yeah, right. By the way, Josh, I was actually we were talking on the way up here, because we're in San Diego now at American Icon Autographs, where you could actually get signatures from Barnett and Kerr and everyone, all the other amazing stars. But we were talking about how you are a guy with just high school wrestling, and you beat Dan Severn, who's an Olympian, and you beat Randy Couture, two Olympians, and that's gotta have, I mean, you gotta feel pretty good.
Well, it's like I was telling you, Randy had been doing so much striking work in these matches, even leading up to ours. I didn't even know I was gonna fight Randy at the time I did. I wasn't the first choice. I got the call, and I had 6 weeks, so I'm like, oh yeah, whatever, I'll do it. But I watched him against Pedro Hizo, I watched him against Vitor Belfort. And I'm watching these fights, and he's fighting strikers, and he's using almost nothing but striking to win these fights, and the occasional takedown. And he's training with Maurice Smith quite a bit, and so I'm thinking, all right, he's going to try and throw down with me on the feet. I'll work on this. I worked a lot with Reese Andy and some other guys up there in terms of wrestling, because even though I only wrestled in high school, I spent all of my years in fighting always working with wrestlers like Matt Yushchenko, or Tom Erickson when I could, or Rico Ciparelli, or one of my main training partners in my last few fights has been Tony Nelson from University of Minnesota. So I always keep real tight to my wrestling roots. You know, I consider myself a wrestler first, and everything branches off from that. And working with guys like Joel Sherritt. So I'm thinking, all right, I'm going to put hands on this guy. He wants to fight me on the feet, dirty box and all this. And each round I would come out, I'd line up on him, I'd throw a vicious right hand, he'd just shoot a double on the foot.
Yeah.
Down I go. I'm like, okay, I guess we're down here. Attack a bunch of subs and stuff off my back. We get back to the feet, throw some knees in up against the fence, and first round ends. Come out in the second round again, right hand, double leg. God damn it.
Now, I mean, were you talking any shit to him at the Durin? Like, come on, man, keep it on the feet?
Nah. To me, though, I was really surprised because, you know, we had trained together before, and, you know, the submission stuff was always really where I excelled, so I figured, well, he'd probably want to shut that element of my game down and not allow me to really be able to work it. And I knew that the fight was in my hands the minute, you know, I'm fighting him off my back, but I'm hitting him with elbows and punches, and he's trying to land, he's not really able to get anything clean in, and I'm doing a good job of tying him up. And then at some point he backs off and he tries to pass my guard, and I'm like, he never does that.
Yeah.
And as soon as he did that, I scooped into his leg, went after a leg lock, and then that was, he bailed. I front headlocked him, snapped him, got on top, soccer kicked his body, and then just went to town.
Is that your favorite win?
It was a great win, I got to admit. Being able to fight, you know, Randy is a Washington native too. He's from Lynnwood, Washington originally. Yeah. Watching Randy go out there, win all those fights, become the champion, you know, he was somebody that I greatly looked up to. So there was no diminishing of Randy in my mind by fighting and beating him. That didn't really – that. Who he represented and what he represented as for me as a young athlete growing up is still a great strong impression. And so, you know, I was always super proud watching Randy go out there and win.
You know what's interesting about that, Josh, is from the first time when you and I competed against each other, you were young. I was going to say 19. Yeah. But from that first, and this is being straight up with you, from that first go, I knew that it was only a matter of time that you were going to make an impact on the sport. I mean, honestly, because literally it's just you didn't care. You just went as hard as you possibly could go. And literally, and I say this to whoever I'm talking to, it's just like the irony of us having to compete year to year, you know, 2 years in a row. The first time, I was hoping to God the second year, you're on the other side of the bracket.
I was actually thinking the same thing. I didn't think I was getting – I remember the first time I wrestled you, I was like, this is what it feels like to wrestle your dad. You know, like, God, you know, he's just – how do I – this guy is just – it just feels like a whole difference in terms of, like, physicality. I'm like, I know I got stuff, but I can't make any of it stick.
Execute,
and you got north south on me the first year, and I'm like, I couldn't remove you no matter what I did. So the next year I'm like, hey Matt, am I going? He's like, nah. I'm like, okay. I kind of fucked around. And then all of a sudden he's like 2 weeks out, he goes, you're going. I'm like, oh, God damn it. All right, so I'm gonna do my best. And then the first round, I'm like, Mark, I'm like, okay, the one thing I'm not gonna let happen is him get north south. I'm like, at one point I let you go after Mount. I'm like, I'm gonna do everything I can to try and find a way to attack. I just don't let him get north south. And at one point you spin around in north south. I'm like, no. And I do everything, and I just left my arm behind, and it's like crank. I'm like, fuck, I forgot. Yeah, he knows how to do those too.
Yeah.
But all I could think of was, don't get caught in north south. You know, whatever you do, don't get caught in fucking north south. It was such a frustrating it's like 5 minutes of being stuck in north south and being able to go
nowhere. Was he the strongest guy you ever grappled against?
One of them. Well, I always tell people there's my litmus test for strength is like the Coleman.
Oh yeah.
You can only get as strong as Mark Coleman, and then it starts to become like the length of your levers or the weight behind you. It's like Bob Sapp is as strong as Mark Coleman, but he just had more weight. Or a longer lever at certain points, you know, just like a bigger body. But I remember the first time Coleman put me in a front headlock, I was like, Jesus fucking Christ.
I call it old man strength for him.
Yeah, he literally just turns just purple and just starts.
Different litmus tests.
Oh, man.
For strength. But, and one is as strong as I was and as much as I trained and competed.
You were strong
Mark,
as shit, but you also felt more supple than Mark.
Yeah, and Mark was just, he's all horsepower. I mean, it's just one where, you know, not much flexibility. It was one way and straightforward. So
he just give you that fucking sideways look.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, man. And I tell Mark, and I'll tell him this very day, I go, look, I'm going to take you down. Some. I don't care if you got a walker or a wheelchair. I'm going to tip that fucker over, and I'm going to call two. Because I would shoot on him and pommel. I couldn't get him on his back, you know?
But, Mark, you were an Abu Dhabi champion, right? Now, were you even – but you were still a white belt when you won it?
You know what's interesting? I don't even know how to classify belt because I had a brown belt in judo. Right. And so going to jiu-jitsu, it was just with a gi on. It frustrated me. It was like somebody having being an octopus. So I'd go out to Beverly Hills Jiu-Jitsu and I'd roll with guys out there and they'd roll with gis. And I was doing it, I think, just to be polite. And then there's a point where I'm like, I'm never putting a gi on again, no matter what.
But
there's so many different elements that come into play.
But how frustrated are these guys? Because, like, I mean, name some of the guys you beat.
Mario Sperry,
Bustamante,
yep. Carlos Beheto.
These guys are
Beheto was actually on a real surgence of his fight career and his grappling career. He was really kind of hitting his peak stride, and he was known for being, you know, a big guy, but long, thin legs,
super long levers,
and good at using elevators. And he elevated Mark at one point, and fucking Mark basically just rode it, cartwheeled, landed, and then high fived him. It's like, you're not getting this dude off his feet. It's just not happening. And just to see these Brazilians being like, but you know, with hand control and head control, Mark would just continually shut that game down and then just use good hips.
I mean, how frustrated are these guys are that these guys are like third, fourth, fifth degree black belts, and this American wrestler.
They hadn't wrestled a wrestler that had an understanding of what was going on.
I think that was the difference. When I first started fighting, at some point there was this introduction to Boss Rutten, Oleg Taktarov, Pedro Hizo, Marco Huaz. Those are the guys I go out to California and roll around with. And for the first 6 months, I probably tapped probably 20 times a workout session because I just wanted to get an understanding of what elements I needed to figure out. And then once I figured it out, I kind of just put my foot down and I go, okay, I think I got a good understanding of where the danger points are, of what positions they're trying to get me in, and what I need to avoid. And so it was just this whole learning curve where, you know, thankfully I didn't have a prideful, you know, going, well, I'm going to go in there and show them. So I think it was just taking that time to really try to understand what it is. I think that's what helped me at least transition into doing, you know, the Abu Dhabi.
What I think of sometimes is I think that, like, okay, so you wrestled in college. You were a national champion. You beat Randy Couture in the finals.
Yeah.
Now, were you and Randy friends? Were you guys cool back then? Was there a rivalry?
You know what's interesting is that in Randy, and we'll have to scratch his head for this, we wrestled my junior year. Okay.
Yeah.
And when we wrestled my junior year, it was at dual meet. It was somewhere in Virginia, and he beat me. He beat me by gassing me. So
what does that mean? Tired him out.
Because one thing, Randy, he's what I call he's a pusher. You know, most Greco guys are pushers, so they just push and push and push and push, and it's a really, really heavy intensity. And the reason why I beat him in the NCAA championship because every time he pushed, I changed my level, double legged him. That was basically it.
Right.
So from that one lesson, he beat me 5-4 my junior year, and then we met again my senior year, and the rest is kind of history.
But I think sometimes of like parallel universes, right? Because I think, okay, you wrestled Kurt Angle in the Olympic trials.
Yep.
And Kurt beats you by 1 point.
Mm-hmm.
Now I think, what if you would have beaten Kurt? And you went to the Olympics and win the gold medal. And then Kurt goes on to MMA and becomes this big UFC star.
He's like my doppelganger, you know?
Do you think Angle could have been a fighter?
You know,
he's got intensity. He knows how to work hard. Does.
And that's the one thing that I think from Kurt's perspective, the first two years we competed against each other, 93-94, I annihilated him. He didn't score a point on me at Nationals, the Freestyle Nationals in 94. And from his work from 94 to 95, I couldn't touch him. He literally just worked his way into being at a level that's equal to and greater than I was. So I know the work ethic was there. Whether or not he would have the stomach for it, it's a whole nother.
Yeah, that's that whole thing. You know, what do you do when you get punched in the face?
Yeah.
How do you react to that? And then You know, like talking in the Smashing Machine, it's like, well, I'm gonna get him back doubly, so that way, you know, the odds are ever never even. I'm always going to get ahead. But then there's also those guys like, okay, well, they can take an extreme competitive angle version of it. They can take like, you know, like a, I'm gonna just fucking kill you.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
But there's always that mentality of I will win, mm-hmm. no matter the cost. Whereas some guys are like, you know what, that's just not something I'm willing to deal with. Like they just can't. Couldn't, I mean, there's fighters, I mean, that have 30, 40 fights under their belt that still don't like fucking getting hit.
Yeah.
You know, they're just like,
yeah.
You know, they're just not into it.
Look at Brock. Look how big and strong Brock was. Yeah. And then
he did better his last fight, but he's still flinching. You know, it's still not something that he's comfortable with. Or, you know, Tito has never been, he's got good hands on the offense, but he does not like being on the end of them.
You know what's even, I was up at Big Bear. And with Rico Rodriguez, Chuck Liddell, Tito Ortiz, and a list of a bunch of other people up there. And we'd watch before Chuck got the push by the UFC, and they're pushing Tito. In their sparring sessions, the second that Chuck laid wood on Tito, he would just clam up.
Yep.
You'd see it in the fights. You see it in all their fights.
And he always just does a big high double shield. Yep. And he's not looking to see what's happening. He's not moving. So while he thinks he's protected, he's still a target.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I was watching an interview, and you said you hadn't touched a drug till you were 26. Mm-hmm. And then that was what you became a pro fighter at, what, 26?
27.
So you're going to Brazil, right? This is real.
Yeah.
This is the real deal. You said you were broke.
Yeah.
You didn't know what to do. You go to Brazil, and you took, someone gave you, was it like those old high school after school specials where you're in the locker room and somebody says, hey man, try this?
I actively sought it out. It was one of those where I think my lack of understanding of what I was going to do, I think the saying at the time that I kept repeating in my head was, if you're going to a gunfight, bring a gun.
Right.
You know, type of thing. So it was one where at that point, competing and trying out for the Olympics and stuff, you're tested at the highest standards.
Well, you also know that when you get on that mat, the rules are going to be, in general, officiated across the board. You're going to have neutrality. Yeah. You're going to be going to Brazil.
Totally different.
No, you're not. No. You're not. I mean, Coleman's telling stories about watching before Van Arsdale goes out there watching his opponent getting full-on greased up with baby oil.
Yeah.
Like, the hell? What?
Yeah.
That's okay? Yeah. You know?
But you're also not one of these guys, I mean, that, like, had no success before. You see some of these guys, like, they're 5-5, and all of a sudden they start taking stuff, and their bodies change, and now they go on a 10-fight winning streak. I'm not saying Dos Anjos, okay, but that's that was the word out there. But you're a guy, you had a lot of success without the stuff.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like you needed the stuff. Was it more nerves?
I think it was more of a general lack of understanding of what I was getting myself into. And I just said, you know, I thought in my head that I needed the extra edge, you know, to be able to go down there and do it. I mean, it's just one where when I tell the story to people that don't understand it, I go, okay, my first fights were 3 fights, 1 night, hotel, Max Suit Plaza, really no time limits because they wanted somebody to be the winner. And you're going to fight in a room full of 900 Brazilian men. Are you in? You know, that was kind of the thing going, I had no clue it was going to take the shape that it did and turn into what it turned into.
And people need to remember that when I started fighting, when Mark started fighting, there were no just schools you could go and learn fighting. There wasn't there wasn't this general understanding of the environment that you were going to step into, where everybody has this like, oh, I can just go down to the UFC gym in La Mirada, or I can go here, I can go there, you know, I can go to this Gracie Baja, I can do whatever, right? You know, I can do jiu-jitsu, I can do kickboxing, go watch it on TV, you know, it's all sort of an understood. To us, it was like, okay, you find what you can find. Mm. You know, I didn't find an actual full-on fight school for being an MMA fighter until I'd fought 2 of their guys and two pros on their cards and won. And then it's like, oh, well, there's one in Seattle at AMC. I knew that. I knew there was a Lion's Den somewhere. I knew there was like, but where are these places? You know, how does this work out? So, you know, I went to Matt Hume and...
I mean, there's no internet back then.
Well, there was, but
it was dial-up.
Yeah, yeah. It was Netscape Navigator, bro.
I mean, is it like, hey, man, there's this gym that everyone knows?
I fought guys from internet chat rooms, by the way.
Really?
I mean, I met this guy, and he's like, oh, you know, I've been traveling around. I've had this many fights. You know, I weigh this much, I'm this old, and like, what, would you be interested in a match? I'm like, yeah, I'll fight you. I'm cool. I'm 19. I'm blah, blah, blah. He goes, oh yeah, I saw your fight with Chris Jarno. So I met this guy at the Washington Athletic Club. I sign in as a guest, go up to the judo room. We close the door. We decide the rules. I just full out fight the guy.
Wow. For free.
Yeah. Wow. Yes. And that's, I mean.
Did you win?
Yes. Yeah. I won like 24 fights before.
Was
I
it a fight to
one.
The death? I mean, was there a ref there?
There was no ref.
So, I mean, how did you decide this fight's over? He just said it's over.
He gave up.
Did you shake his hand afterwards? Or?
Yeah, we sat and talked, and he's like, oh, yeah, I think I'm going to come back out in the summer. You know, Matt said he'd like me to come out and fight again on one of his cards. And so, even knowing that, then when I would go to the University of Montana's like rec center, they had the old wrestling mats from their program that used to exist, right?
Yeah.
And they had various martial arts programs, some certain stuff. And so what I would do is I would find anybody, if it's a kid hitting a heavy bag, some buff frat boy lifting weights, talk about how tough he is, or like some dude in a gi. I'm like, hey, how you doing? You know, hey, my name's Josh. I see you like fighting or whatever, blah, blah, blah. Hey, you ever watch UFC? Like, oh, yeah. What do you think about it? Oh, man, it's fucking cool, man. I love that stuff. Yeah, man, me too. Do you want to fight? And they're like, what?
Wow.
You know, like, yeah, we'll
work
out
like
the
rules. You're like a human troll. Like, yeah. They're like, hey, buddy, how's it going?
And so, I mean, there'd be times where the mats, the upstairs mats, there's like a little, there's a climbing wall. There's like four full court basketball courts, and there's this cargo net hanging between the basketball courts and the wrestling mats. And then there's like a little room for cardio with like some small windows. It was kind of like the woman's workout room, but it wasn't really set up that way. It's just that's sort of how it worked out. So there'd be a girl on the stair stepper looking through the thing. There's people playing basketball, and so the balls can't come over into your area and all that. So that's why the cargo net's there. And I would just be fighting people up there.
Oh my God.
And you know, all of a sudden people would be hanging on the cargo nets, and like the background of the Street Fighter 2, you know, area, and cheering as I'm beating the shit out of people.
Wow. Wow. Now what is it that at that point,
and, you know, that's the other thing is, but no one ever came to be like, hey, are you guys actually fighting? They just thought, oh, well, these guys must just be martial arts.
At that point, are you doing it to get better, or because
I needed to get experience, and I trained with Jim Harrison and his Bushido Kan Karate School, which, you know, we did kickboxing and judo, and we'd full on go with guys, but I'm trying to express the lawlessness, the raw element back then of like, holy fuck, you know, this was like 80s sports movie kind of montage shit. That's the world that Mark and I lived in. And so it's like, do you want to go down there and fight in front of this thing with these, you know, there's this guy that they pulled out of a ditch in the jungle. There's this guy that you know, pulls alligators out of the water with his bare hands. There's this guy who's, you know, it's just, and so Mark's like, fuck yeah, I'll be there, you know?
It reminds me of like one of the first UFC where the boxer shows it with like
Art Jimerson. Yeah,
one glove.
So it just is one where that and what it is now is just, it's been cleansed.
But your second fight in, right? When you use your chin to put the guy's eye socket,
that was bogus. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, was that one of your like, okay, did you practice that in practice?
Yeah,
or?
I think my training partner would appreciate it.
Yeah,
that was just, I wanted to, like anything else, I just wanted the fight to be over.
He was a big son of a bitch, too. You know, anybody that knows Bobish that would say, look, if Bobish knew how dangerous he could be, he would be near unstoppable. Like the guy was
a huge, strong guy. I mean, with a super low center of gravity.
Powerful,
I mean,
quick.
Big, huge legs, and actually really nimble on his feet.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, I remember watching the Smash Machine again last night. You go over to Pride because you're like, okay, the money's better, right? Yeah. But then you go there, you're like, hey, $3,300, you guys still owe me.
Yeah.
Is that what you were, I mean, I'm like, how bad was the original money? We're fucking 33, like.
No, what I ended up doing, and this is what I told Pride, I said, after my first year of fighting, I said, I need to basically know how much money I'm making per month. I said, if you want me to be successful, you're going to put me on salary. And when I'm on salary, every time I fight, it's a bonus on top of the salary.
Okay.
That was what Ken would have people do with his old SEG contracts, was Lion's End guys were on a monthly.
Yeah. And it stabilized my life. It allowed me, they were paying me at the beginning, it was like $8,333 a month, going, this is your salary. And then every time that I fought like Hugo Duarte or, you know, some of the other guys I fought, I would get a fight bonus paid in cash. So just one where that level of stability was all that I needed.
Right.
And so if you look at like my first fight with Pride, they actually went from a company called KRS to Dream Stage. So the first four shows were KRS, and then they went to Dream Stage. That's when they got rid of the mobster, put legitimate people in there, and they started to, you know, push it, you know, mainstream. And so,
well, minus Hideki and Yukino.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I know. I mean, it has a whole backstory to it, but it's just one where they ended up saying, okay, if we're willing to do this, we're going to push you. And I would go over like 2 weeks prior to an event. I would do TV. I would do charity stuff. I would do print. I would do whatever they asked me to do, you know.
And they always pay you for that stuff too, which was cool.
And it's just one where it got to a point where if you look at the little time frame, it's when I had the runoff for Abu Dhabi, you know, boom, 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 you know, super champ. It just created stability financially. And that's what any fighter that's.
I feel like that they should do that right now with the UFC, put people on salary versus.
It is something that they could do. Like there is no set way that a company like UFC or any MMA company has to structure their deals. And they could just as a manager could go to the UFC and say, well, instead of doing this fight bonus, win bonus, you know, let's
do a stipend.
Yeah, you know, I mean, but I don't know if the UFC would go for it.
Right,
it changed. It just, I know what it did for me.
Sure,
you know, it's like that first $25,000. It's even funnier because I didn't read the fine print. Federico Lependo put in there.
Of course,
maybe subject to local
no
taxes.
Way.
Right.
Federico Lependo.
So he ended up paying me like $18,000. Right? And so I chased him for that $7,000. Basically, I caught him in California, and he actually did pay me. It took him a while, but I was like subject to nothing. So it was interesting.
Who'd you fight on that night? You fought Paul Varlins, Meister Hulk, and
Fabio Gugel.
Fabio Gugel.
Actually, Alex, that was here earlier. Yeah. That's his introduction to me. Like that was his jiu-jitsu instructor down in Brazil.
Gugel.
Yeah.
Oh wow! Didn't you fight Ebenezer Fonts Braga at one point too? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there are some. You know the names a little bit better because I, unfortunately. When I unplugged from the industry, I unplugged. I mean, most people thought I died, rolled over in the corner, buried in some cemetery somewhere. But, you know, the industry's growing enough now where, you know, I'm going to put some stuff together. I can do seminars and do stuff like
good. That. Good. And I was actually showing my girlfriend. I was my fiance. I'm getting married this Saturday.
Oh, congrats.
But I was showing her your video, and she was like, man, he should go to high schools and colleges and public speaking. Like, she was like, this is exactly what, you know, kids need to listen to right now. I'm like, it's exactly what you should be doing. Because, I mean, who better than someone who's been through what you've been through?
Yeah, it's an experience where, you know, thankfully, I think that besides the competitions and stuff, the one thing that has changed the whole paradigm in my life is being a dad.
Right.
You know, I have a great 12-year-old son, and if anything happened to me, I mean, the kid wouldn't even know what to do.
Are you still working at the car dealership?
Still working at the car dealership.
My little brother does that, and I have so much respect. That's a hard job.
It is.
Is this the first time you've met Mark?
Yeah.
Well, I've known Mark for some years.
Yeah.
I can tell. Not because he's slick, but I can tell you that I can easily see Mark getting people to buy a car. No fucking questions
asked. I mean, my little brother wanted to know if you use the same.
He'll make you feel like
spirit.
You made the smartest decision you ever did by buying that car. I promise you. I promise you.
That's what my little brother Max wanted to know, if you use some of the same competitive spirit you use fighting.
You do. I mean, literally, you look at it like if somebody's sitting in front of you, you want to sell them a car, that's the only way you win.
Hmm.
You know, so it's just one where it's funny. In 2008, when the economy fell apart, when I like literally walked away from fighting, you know, I ended up fighting King Mo on like a 3-week notice. You know, I literally, the money was where I go, I can't turn it down.
Right.
You know, so, you know, from that point going forward, it was like, okay, what am I going to do? You know, the whole entire world economy had collapsed.
Did you save any money from your fighting days?
I saved a little bit, you know, a little bit.
Do you still have your NSX?
Oh, I wish I did. That's one of those trophy pieces that I wish it was still sitting in a garage somewhere.
You know, and the trouble about even stuff like that is if you had just kept it to just turn it over now, you would have still made money on the car. Yeah.
So it's interesting because a friend of mine that was selling cars at the time, he goes, here's the way you need to think about this. If you learn how to sell cars, you could actually move to any of the 50 states, have a job tomorrow that you know you can pay your bills with.
Right.
So that's kind of the idea, is that in every town there's, you know, hundreds of car dealerships. You know, if you understand the business and you understand how to do that, you never have to be afraid of not being able to provide a roof and food and, you know, shelter for your family. So I took it on as that and going, okay, you know, now I'm looking at it like, well, now that MMA's blown up, I probably have opportunities out there.
Was also like a college wrestling coach, seminars. Like, I would think that, you know, you'd be very qualified for those.
Yeah, able to do it. Yeah. Well, it's now with a friend of mine. You know Rick Bassman.
Yeah.
So Rick Bassman is starting to put some stuff together. And Alex, who's, you know, friends. I mean, he's known Hoist Gracie forever. You know, Hoist and his network has 225 different dojos that he goes to. So they're going to help me get some stuff set up where I can get back out there.
Oh, good. Because I feel like you need to be out there.
I do.
One of your fights against Igor, this was I was watching that fight last night, and you went out there. You were winning the fight. Now, Coleman said you gassed a little bit. Mm-hmm. Did you gas? And we're like, looking back at it now, 20 years later, do you think you would have won that fight had that not been stopped that way?
You know what? It's one of those things where, as a fighter, you have certain people on your list. I don't know if Josh has that list. That list that you know, no matter what, it's probably going to be one of the hardest fights you've ever stepped into.
Yeah.
And Igor was on that list for me. Going, he's Ukrainian. You know, his upbringing is totally different from ours. You know, he's fighting for every dollar, every cent. It's not like I am not, but it's just a different type of person. You know,
the guys from Dagestan now.
Those guys are just like life or death for their money.
Yeah, it is. And that's kind of the one with Igor, knowing that I would have hoped I would have won, but it would have been an uphill battle. I mean, he hits hard. He hits extremely hard.
He's short and compact. And he just whips hard. Not only just his shots, but, I mean, whips his hips, whips... I mean,
everything.
It wasn't until later you could see there's a point where you see where Igor is just like, eh. And, you know, and then you see him start losing on the ground, like, kind of getting worked over. But there's times, even when a Bobish is killing him, and he eventually gets back on the feet and then lays him out. And he'd been getting kneed in the head on his back for who knows
just
how long.
One of the toughest guys.
Scrappy.
I mean, we talked afterward. Even the second time that I fought him and lost to him, it was one where it was like he just was on the list going, I know I'm going to hurt. I know it's going to be hard.
Yeah.
I know I'm going to have to do everything I can to win, just because when you add that level of toughness and grit in and a talent, you know.
Who's on your list, Josh?
Well, Krokop's always just, you know, regardless that I've never been able to fight that guy 100%. Even 100%, he's going to be hell on wheels.
Yeah.
He's just so powerful and quick. And he's just a load, you know. At the top of his game, you know, I say he's one of the best to ever walk the earth.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
And it's just that level where can I beat him? Yeah, I can beat him, but
it's gonna be everything you got.
It's always gonna be a hard one. It's always gonna be a tough one. And while you know he got knocked out by Randleman, he got subbed by Minotauro, but I'm like, okay, I don't know if Randleman could have repeated that, but you know, Kevin's explosive. He's a dangerous guy, and Minotauro was getting annihilated. He was practically knocked out at the end of the first round. Hail Mary diving tackle and managed to get him onto his back.
Yeah.
Then he grabbed the rope to keep on mount. It's just like, all right. So I think this happens again. Yeah. He gets chewed up, you know, but hey, it is what it
now,
is.
Now, after that fight, you're like, I mean, you're crying. I felt for you. It was your first loss.
Yeah.
I was like, holy shit. You know, I couldn't imagine what you've been going through. You've been a winner this entire time. And it was I felt for you. But your ex-wife, is it your current wife or ex-wife?
She's my girlfriend at the time, became my wife, now my ex-wife. But I'm here in San Diego with her.
Oh, that sounds like a really smart move. Okay,
what a story this is turning out to be. Yeah.
So your ex-wife is like, you know what? I knew he was going to lose. He only trained for a couple of weeks, and we were partying and drinking a week ago. Now, when you're watching the Smash Machine, are you like, hey, listen, a little confidentiality? Is that or is that true? Is that what happened?
No, it wasn't completely true. I mean, the saying is there's her version, my version, and the truth. You know. The truth lies somewhere in the middle.
Right.
You know, I was training, but also I was doing a lot of pain pills and all that stuff back then. And that, you know, if you take it out and go, okay, I'm sober and I fight him, I probably beat him, you know, but you put all the other elements in there.
Well, you did you get, know. He wasn't supposed, the grounded knees wasn't sorted out at that point. And so that fight, that first fight got turned into a no contest. Yeah,
it did. Yeah.
But still, it's like you a no contest while I'm getting front headlocked and knee in the head while I'm tired. You know?
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
and
that's
I tell
no,
him afterward, I literally, you know this, like Mr. Ishii,
yeah.
K1.
Watching you talk
not,
to Mr. Ishii,
not,
right? and Adam goes, look at him, he's talking to this Japanese guy. This guy has no idea. I go, Mr. Kancho Ishii does speak English, but at this moment, it's not even about whether or not Ishii understands him. Mark is just like, somebody has to fucking hear this right now because this is killing me that I just got fouled and they stopped the fight.
Well, you know, I mean, it doesn't matter what the decision is afterward. Everybody only remembers what happened in
for
the
real.
Ring. So he kneed me, they raised his hand, so that's what everyone remembers.
Yeah, that's what sets in their mind.
So it's just one where it's unfortunate. I know that, you know, I know he's not that fighter that would go, oh, dude, I'm going to follow him, you know, screw it. I know he's not that guy.
Yeah.
You know, but the transition before the, I mean, Pride had so many things that didn't protect the fighters. You know, you could be in a 3-point stance and they could punt your head. You know, I mean, they had so much stuff in there, literally, and they tried to thin it out, at least have a little bit better, you know, fighter safety. And that is why they took the, when you're down, you can't knee him to the head.
Well, I mean, look,
all
I mean,
that stuff was in.
I mean,
and then they put it back in anyways.
Yeah, they did.
I mean, it was, it can be hard to keep track of some of that stuff. But, and you know who was also like that, which really surprised me at first, because I didn't get to know the guy that well until after it was Crow Cop, was that, you know, when I fought him the finals of the heavyweight openweight Grand Prix, you know, I'm hurting from fighting Minotauro. Crow Cop's now, he's laying in on me here on the ground. And I'm like, fuck it. So I scoop his leg and I'm going to try and go after a leg lock. And he posts out and he's trying to keep me from getting into him. And he accidentally eye gouges me like two knuckles deep. It's totally accident.
Yeah.
Right.
But at the time, it's like both eyes shut, closed. I'm like, I can't see anything. And I remember... Bobish got eye gouged against Goodridge, and then I've seen another guy accidentally take an eye poke, and then they didn't stop it, and they're getting waylaid, and I'm just thinking, oh shit, this guy's probably going to let Crow Cop start trying to kick my head into the next row. So I tapped, but what, you know, at the time, I'm thinking, fuck, when I see the replay, Crow Cop's like, oh shit, he knew he accidentally gouged me, and then Yuji, and sees me grab my face, and Yuji looks, and so for once, they would have been like, oh, something happened.
Yeah.
And now I've got lost by tap out due to strikes on my record. And it's like, Jesus Christ.
Josh,
but nobody understands like that situation in the heat of that moment. Yeah. Yeah. Like,
I don't think anyone's calling you a pussy, Josh.
Well, I am what I eat.
No, right.
But then that would mean I'm an asshole too.
I mean, speaking of which, I mean, do you look at these new guys, Mark, and think to yourself, like, this, you know, I was a fighter. Some of these guys were fighters too, but they're athletes. And this is sort of a, you know.
I'm real curious to hear this. I really am.
I mean,
I've got some.
Do you look at these guys and go, what I did was fighting? Like we were headbutting and eye gouging and kicking and stomping and fighting with no weight classes and no rules. And these guys, it's sort of it's fighting, but it's not what I was doing.
It's different. I mean, to say it's different is like going, I don't even know what a parallel is, but, you know, like really what you were doing, like going around to college and fighting, that's what we were doing in a ring and getting paid for it. And that's a difference.
Yeah, the first time I got money, I was like, oh shit. I was hearing a hook and shoot at the time. Like, yeah, we play like a minimum of $350. I'm like, $350, that's great.
Yeah.
You know, like, wow, when can I get $350?
Yeah, it's changed. I think the whole entire premise of MMA was like, okay, which discipline's the toughest? Just take who you are. Doesn't matter what you weigh. Doesn't matter how long it takes. We're going to figure this out.
Yeah, every tournament was basically like a movie script. You know, we're going to bring these guys in from all over and we're going to set it all up and then see who comes out on top.
And that really, I think, was more of a true measure of like really what your grade was as a fighter. Going, hey, dude, we're going to whittle the rules down to the minimum. You know, don't grab his nuts and don't poke him in the eye.
Yeah, don't
bite.
Everything
else is on board because it's almost like, hey, guys, we're going to throw you in this locker room. We need one of you guys to come out.
Right.
Okay. And that was literally the feeling going into fighting was like, okay, I'm in a locker room. I need to come out.
Yeah, but you understand, we were down. We were totally for it.
Oh, yeah.
And you couldn't say that anybody there was forced to be there. They were like, I mean, we could all have our external reasons, but at the end of the day, we truly wanted to fucking be there. We wanted to do that. We the there was a, it felt so special to see some of these events at that time too, because it would be such a like, oh my God, they got that guy and then they got this guy. Oh, I can't believe that they put this whole thing together. How wild is that? And, you know, I've said for years that, that fighting isn't alike in a lot of ways. Of course, there are things that, that us in the early days would not have been prepared for with the media stuff and how to manage a career and to navigate those business end of the waters. But the fighting part of it, so different. So this guy, this local promoter, wanted to put on a, an eight-man one-night tournament, which you can still do in California, but you, it's like you have to limit the total fight time to 25 minutes. That's their gimmick on that.
Okay.
And he's like, I want to do this one-night tournament. And I got my guy, and I go, we're down. You know, he fought Kyokushin, you know, karate as a 19-year-old kid as the youngest ever in the world open weight tournament. So, yeah, we're all good. You know, this is what I come from. Like, this is how we fight.
The background, yeah.
And couldn't get eight guys to agree to that. Like, most of them was like, no way. I'm not fighting three times in one night. And I'm like, really?
Yeah.
You know? That's where it started. Fuck, that's what we were about. And, you know, the show up like that, it was just like, all right, here we are, let's go, let's put this together. And I remember talking about the difference between fighters in the day and the passion to just get out there and fight, and like, what are the rules for this one? All right, good, let's go. What have you? No gloves? Cool. Headbutts? Yeah, awesome. Whatever, we're all here to do it. And I remember after this it was a UFC, it was one of those press conference calls, and Benson Henderson goes, no. You're right. I don't want to do that. Right. I wouldn't want to be. I don't want to do any of that. I like, this is cool. And I was like, well, wow, I can't believe somebody's actually.
Yeah.
You know, but you know, it's fine with that too. You know, I mean, no one can take away what a lot of these young, awesome athletes are doing, like a Benson Henderson. You know,
I mean, the cool thing is the sport, because where it's grown, it's pulled into some incredible talented guys. It really has. You know, and still like anything else, man, the thing that I loved about wrestling, even though I was a big guy, is that you could be 135 pounds or 145 pounds, and you could be a world champ.
Right.
You know, and there's no other sport really you could do that with. You know, it can't be a pro football player. You might baseball, you know. So it's given guys opportunities. I mean, I can appreciate where the sport has come from and where it is. It just, there's
just a little different.
It's a parallel.
Now, do you watch it now at all?
You know what? I started over the last couple of years watching it. You know, a lot of times I get frustrated because I get so much anxiety watching it that I can't watch it and enjoy it.
Mm.
You know, because you know how much it hurts. Like watching somebody take a headshot or watching some. I mean, I know how much it hurts and it makes me cringe. So sometimes the anxiety level. And in the last year, I've been able to actually sit and enjoy it and, you know, watch. I like the technical part of it. I like when you get a really good, you know, people might think it's boring watching two guys on the ground, but you get the camera angles. I'm like, oh, yeah, cool. Oh, yeah. You know, you can see somebody totally, you know, working their game. And it's interesting where the sport is now.
Mayweather McGregor. My personal opinion, this is going to go three rounds tops. I don't know why they're doing this. I mean, I know why they're doing it.
Of course, we know why they're doing it.
But I just feel like this is
the name of the fight. It's called Cha-Ching in the Ring.
Yeah. Really? Nah. Who do you think? How do you think this goes down?
I mean, as an MMA fighter, I'd love to see McGregor knock him out. I mean, I really would.
It would do something for us. Yeah.
The statistically saying, I mean, him, the odds, I don't know even what the odds are now, 1 to 20 or something. I mean, it's just one where I would love to see him knock out Mayweather. I've never liked Mayweather, never, you know, just one where it's just not an athlete I followed or enjoyed or anything like that. So, of course, I like to see McGregor knock him out.
Me too. But
I get why people don't like Mayweather, and a lot of that I feel is constructed. You know, I mean, it's one way to get someone's attention. Yeah. But his ability, his defensive and boxing work has always been a thing of beauty to mine, something I've tried to emulate in some ways, which must be unsuccessful with the amount of times I've seen him. I think, I don't know, three, probably, I think it's like four, maybe five. I think McGregor's endurance will be up. But he's going to get tired missing.
Hitting
Mayweather. And at that point, once that gas tank starts to diminish, because the pacing and the timing. And
so everything, so round five, really, you think? Round five, round six?
By five or six, that's going to be the end of the fight. And I don't think it's going to be because Mayweather just completely shuts his lights out, but I think he's just the gas toll. Yeah, he's going to gas. He's going to dig his body up. And
so how does?
But right. I'd like to see Conor give a great showing, or, you know, put his lights out. I mean, that would make something great for MMA.
Yeah. I mean, it really would.
So how does
really
prime would. Mark Kerr, I don't care if you're on stuff, okay? I'm talking about 1997, androgen, whatever the fuck you took. All right, Mark Kerr against today's heavyweights. How does he do?
Today's heavyweight. So one thing that I would say is if I had...
You fuck them all up. Come on.
I would. I just... You know what? And this is what I say. I said what made me really good is I can turn anybody that has any discipline, I can make them wrestle me. If I make you wrestle me, I'm going to win. If I turn it into a fight, you know, guys are so technical now, some of the heavyweights. I mean, it would take me probably 2 years with the best boxing and Muay Thai coaches to get to that level they are now. I mean, right now you got some great strikers.
Yeah, but you go against Stipe Miocic. You just double leg him and pound him.
Down to the ground.
Well, you got to figure, if we're talking Mark Kerr in his prime, however that concoction is created, doesn't matter. None of that. All taken out of the main thing is, though, is that Mark's going to be, as I talk about him, as he's sitting right next to me, he's going to be in the environment with the gym setups that we have now, with the training systems, with all the training partners, with having the specialized coaching come in. I mean, I don't think you could help but see a better Mark Kerr than the one you saw before.
So prime Mark Kerr versus prime Brock Lesnar. How does this fight go?
Oh, I'm taking Brock out.
Yeah.
I'm taking him out.
Josh?
I think a good scramble, a couple takedown, you know, goes here and there, but eventually, Mark gets on top, starts going to town. Now, of course, this is old school UFC rules, so there's headbutts and elbows.
Yeah,
we have to actually implement that.
Yeah.
Right.
Put that in there. It's a game changer.
Now, I got to say, it did seem like your girl, Dawn, a very attractive girl, sexy. Mm-hmm. I see why you would like a girl like that, you know? But it did seem like, in a way, she was like, hey, you stayed with her instead of training with Boz in that prime Grand Prix.
Yeah.
Do you look back and be like, I know it was good pussy, right? I know.
Years down the road.
But looking back, are you just like, fuck, I wish I would have done a little.
Yeah, I mean, part of it, and I've said this before, she's been always kind of that little bit of kryptonite for me. You know, just one of those where, you know, looking back on it, you know, and I had spent 3 more weeks out there, probably would end up being in a totally different story.
Right.
You know,
tickles
totally
your prostate
different.
And breaks your heart.
Yeah.
But she did help you get sober.
Yeah.
She helped you get clean.
Yeah.
I mean, no
she's,
one else
she's
was
a great mom.
Now when you're juiced to the gills and you're going out there and you're just your coaches, right? Like that scrawny guy behind you, who was that guy? There was some guy behind you that was like,
I think you're talking about my brother.
Was it your brother?
Yeah,
but now are they saying to you, look, Mark, like, come on, man, you got to get off this stuff, or I'm worried about your liver? Is anybody telling you this, or is it just your girl?
You know what? It was just her. You know, a lot of the environment. I think
it would be hard to talk Mark out of any of it, because he would go, now let me tell you here. So there's this peer-reviewed study and this, and then, you know, that they were saying in Japan with you know, they're eating this type of seaweed, but within that seaweed, and everyone's like, no, he knows exactly what he's talking about.
So were you one of those guys, the bodybuilders who, like, within 5 minutes, you're convinced that everyone should be on stuff?
Well, you know, I did, back then, I mean, it was hard because the internet was in its infancy. I mean, I would order books online and do all this stuff. So I did a lot of reading, and I did a lot of trying to understand what I was doing in my body. What I look back on is that most of the people around me were basically yes guys.
Yeah.
You know, they were sitting on the coattails. They're waiting to be drug along with them. You know, a couple guys were my paid training partners. So, you know, it wasn't them having me, you know, go, hey, Mark, you need to pump the brakes. You need to slow down. Or, you know, my whole attitude was, I'll clean it up when I'm done.
I'm
going to rush ahead as hard as I can, and then when I crash and fall, I'll figure it out.
Were you Coleman and Randleman injecting each other in the butts? Was it like, were you guys back there?
We actually, all three of us trained a ton together, but no, we did our own stuff.
They probably all got into like wrestling matches in hotel rooms out of nowhere, because I've been a witness to that myself.
Yeah.
By the way,
yeah.
Mark Coleman is a fucking great storyteller. He will have you laughing your ass off.
And
that guy... Man, fuck, he's so funny.
He's amazing. He's one of my favorite people.
I love Mark.
Him, and also, I've had him on the podcast numerous times. He's amazing. And Randleman was my favorite guest of all time.
What a wild card that guy was, man. Rest in peace, man.
Broke my heart, man. Broke my heart when he died.
Do you think he could have been one of the best ever?
Yeah.
He was, he had a talent.
Athletically, but put it this way. Before I wrestled Randy Couture, my senior year, it was Kevin's sophomore year, I think, and he had already lost his freshman year in the NCAA finals, and he's getting ready to go. Him and I warmed up together, right? He grew up in Sandusky, Ohio. I grew up in Toledo. They're 60 miles apart. And so him and I warm up, and he looks at me right before he's going to run out, and he goes, "Be ready. It's going to be quick." And I go, okay. So he runs out, and I'm not going to remember. I think the guy he wrestled was a guy named Olson from, like, Nebraska or something. And I'm listening to the crowd. You hear the crowd. You hear the crowd like, yeah. The crowd dies down, and then you hear the crowd pop again. And literally see Kevin running back through the tunnel.
No way.
I told you it'd be quick. Yeah, he decked him in the first, like, 2 minutes of the first.
He was unbelievable. Now, a fight that he always wanted that I always wanted in their primes, Randleman versus Tito.
Oh.
People always debate who would have won.
It had to do with it's all about Randleman's head. But Kevin would have put I mean, I'll give Tito some credit that he managed to take his wrestling in MMA and be very effective with it.
Yeah.
But
not at
Randleman would have just...
Kevin was a three-time NCAA finalist, two-time NCAA champ, and he got kicked out his senior year of Ohio State.
Right.
So you imagine he could have been one of the few. There's a handful of guys that are four-time NCAA finalists.
Yeah.
He had been a three-time NCAA champ, and literally the guy was just a freak of nature. He really was. He had incredible quickness, explosiveness, and just,
toughness. I mean, he pulled the wires out of his wired up jaw out to go, and it's just like with pliers.
Too,
he's nuts. Yeah, bonkers. You know, we fight on the same card. We say like, oh, what's up? Yeah, I'll see you out and about. Blah blah blah. In Atlantic City, Kevin leaves. I go off. As I'm rolling back into the hotel, I hear all this screaming and cussing, motherfucking, I'm like, what the hell is he? And I turn around the corner and it's Kevin. Now it's like 3 o'clock in the morning. Like, what the? And he's like, man, this guy fucking pistol whipped me. And I go, what the fuck did you get yourself into? Yeah. Somehow he got into some pissing contest, like war of words with an off-duty cop in Atlantic City.
Which,
you know, who knows, you know, what kind of off-duty cop he had.
Was it when he fought Randy that weekend?
I don't know. It was either that one or when he fought, I don't remember who. And this guy pulls out a pistol and pistol whips Kevin in some club. And I'm like, only you, Kevin.
Yeah.
Only you. Also, first time Kevin meets my parents, he drops his trousers to show me how Pedro Rizzo had kicked him in the inside of his quad and how it had torn. And my mom's just like, the hell?
That's awesome. Now I got to say, now, looking back, I know you don't want to have regrets with the girl, right, with Dawn, because you guys had that. But all the Asian pussy that you could have gotten. I mean, do you look back and just say, well, like, you could have been the king? You
know, Josh can testify to some of this. If I went to Roppongi and I just stood on a corner at my height in Japan, within 30 minutes, I'd have 50 people around me.
It
wow. Crazy.
But I forget about the guys, though, but the women.
The women, it's... Oh, God, I can get into
you
it.
You can have...
No, get into it. Tell us what happened.
Now, there's, just some of the Japanese women. I mean, I don't even know how to describe it.
Was it orgies? Were they throwing themselves at you?
Throwing themselves at me in extremely, extremely tight boxes.
Wow. Okay. Oh, wow. Okay.
I mean, extremely, like trying to shove it in the crack in a drawer.
Wow. So you did hook up with a lot of Asian girls. Okay. Yeah, all right. Okay. So when your girl says, I'm jealous. Okay. Now
it makes sense.
Now it all makes sense.
Right? It's an athlete and sense of entitlement. You know, I'm over there. If I'm over there, it's not really like the rules apply.
It's not cheating.
Country.
Okay.
Plus,
so
you're just sampling the culture. You're getting, you're learning their customs.
So that's how you
squeeze down on a. Yeah.
So this podcast is gonna be called Mark Kerr Likes Tight Asian Pussy. By the way, that's gonna be the head
Does
of this.
Anybody not like that? Is there like?
I know, right?
Is there a segment of men out there or women that are just like, yeah? Could you have the biggest blown out box I've ever seen in my entire life? I'd like to be able to throw my head in there and look around. Yeah. Maybe store a few things for later.
Make sure she says she's had triplets. Make sure that's I'm sure there is a fetish for everything. There's probably a fetish.
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, that slash B on fucking 4chan. If there's not If there's not porn of it, it must be made.
Okay, yeah. So you didn't miss out on that much.
No, so. I didn't. No,
oh,
I
okay. Didn't. That makes me feel better. Like, honestly,
you know, not even just in terms of like them throwing themselves at you. I mean, you would get a female fan will come up and literally be like, can I have a kiss? And you're like, oh, my. What? Yeah. And then just start weeping and shaking crazy. And falling apart. Yeah.
It's wow.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Never experienced anything like it. And Josh could testify to this. Some of the politest fans in the world.
Yes.
But fanatical.
Yes.
Fanatical. 100%. I mean, like, you could walk out and you like you're saying, I mean, a woman shaking, her hand shaking, her almost weeping because you signed or.
So you must have been, a part of me is like, you know, okay, what could have been if I, but I mean, you were the UFC champion, you were the Pride champion,
yeah.
You're getting tons of Asian pussy, you're making money, you're yeah. beating people up.
Yeah.
I don't feel bad at all. I'm envious, man. You,
Mark,
I mean,
Mark had some, man, he, the stories that he must be able to tell from Abu Dhabi. I was there in Abu Dhabi and I remember what a nutso place that was. Yeah. And just hearing like from hour to hour, day to day, like all of a sudden, like, oh no, so-and-so is putting this money down on, like, yeah. What the fuck?
I call, you know, it the this billionaires is... boys club.
Yeah, man. For
I
mean, real.
It literally was, and I don't know if Josh or my first year there, Guy Nevins, who did all the booking yep. and stuff, Guy calls me up, we agree to like a $15,000 appearance fee, and I go, 15 grand for grappling?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I'm in. So I got sick before the first year. I had something called folliculitis, which is related to
it's
to
like staff. Yeah. And yeah.
And all my hair follicles got infected. I lost a bunch of weight. I think there I was probably like maybe 218, 215 somewhere. So I show up, everybody sees me, and I'm like all thinned out. And they're like, oh, God, like something's wrong. So I tell guys, I said, listen, I'm only competing in one event, one match, and then I'm done. So I do the one match. The Crown Prince calls me up after the match is over. Yep. That's again Carlos Bejeto. Calls me up, and he says, I need you to continue. And I said, I'm really not feeling good. I said, you can look. All my hair follicles are infected. And he goes, if you continue, I'll give you another $25,000.
Wow.
So I'm like, okay. I go, okay. So I do the next match, and I say, I'm done. I'm exhausted, physically exhausted. And he does the same thing. He pulls this me keeps, up in the hotel yeah. room, and he goes, I'll give you another $20,000. And I'm like, oh, God. I'm like, okay. So I forget what the purse was. I think the win purse
it's supposed to be like 50, 50 or something like that.
So it turns out where I go from 15 to 25 to he ends up basically getting the semifinals, going in the finals. I walk home with like $95,000 in cash.
Wow.
And no contract, no nothing. It was just his word, handshake. You know, and so I'm thinking, like Josh is thinking, like, how much money did he make off of me?
Yeah.
Right.
You know, if he was willing to pay me that, and he's betting with his other buddies,
yeah.
How much money did he really make off
me? Yeah, that's... yeah. They would go nuts about it. I mean, even when they held a raffle the second year for like
the
first year of the Audi TT, they had a Porsche, they had all
Wasn't
this stuff.
Like that, a Range Rover Discovery.
Yeah, all this kind of stuff. Yeah, all this stuff. Shit, yeah, right? And a crazy. Raffle.
Yeah.
Kurt, have you thought about going?
So all of us are buying like, you know, a couple, you know, tickets here and there.
Yeah.
There are guys in the audience that bought like $150,000 in tickets just so that they could win. And I'm like, you could have bought most of this shit for the money that you paid for the fucking tickets, but they wanted to win.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a different way of living. Not to mention, pretty hilarious to be sitting up there and you don't see girls on the street.
Uh-uh.
You don't see all, you know, like the actual natives of the UAE. They're kind of shielded away from it. All you ever really see is like Filipino or Pakistani, like day laborer workers.
Yeah.
But yet you look up in the audience and they'll be like a hefty dude with some skinny dude behind him just like squeezing his boob the whole time. You're like, that is so strange. I mean, you're just like, is that how you get into your matches? Is you grab a hefty guy's boob?
That's crazy.
I mean, if you're into it, I get it, but in public?
Yeah.
That is weird. Yeah. Have you thought about writing a book or like making it to a movie? Or?
Yeah, I've thought about putting a book together. I think the timing, I looked at it maybe about 5 or 6 years ago, and you know, MMA hadn't grown to the point it is now. And now they I think what I heard last is like the second most popular sport in the world behind soccer. You know, so I think it has more of a, I think if I do a book at this time, it would have more of an impact than if I did one 5-6 years ago.
Has Dana White reached out to you?
You know, I haven't talked to Dana in probably 15 years.
I mean, you should be in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
I mean, why shouldn't you be in the Hall of Fame?
Part of it, and I explained this to Sean, when Bob Meyerowitz, the old owner of the UFC, was selling it to Frank and Lorenzo Fertitta, right? The documentary was being made, and Bob Meyerowitz was fire-selling anything related to the UFC. So we bought a bunch of footage. And so the new owners, Frank and Lorenzo, found out that HBO was going to air this documentary. And they went to HBO and they said, we want to see the documentary before it's going to air, thinking they could stop it if it wasn't something they agreed with. And so HBO basically said to them, you can watch it when it premieres January 19th, like everybody else. And so I think from that point going forward, it always created a little bit of animosity. And so now the new owners, I think it might be a different perspective for them.
I mean, there's no reason, right? Shouldn't he be in the Hall of Fame?
Mark is pretty pivotal in terms of American heavyweight fighters, for sure. And there is a great case to be made for him being a Hall of Fame UFC, because Mark fought before the single super fight eras, too. Yeah. So there was no, like, unilateral heavyweight champion, right? Yeah. That didn't exist yet. So the four-man tournaments were these sort of things they would just put together.
Yep.
And you would be a UFC champ of these individual tournaments, you know?
I'm a huge Uriah Faber fan, but Faber never won the UFC belt.
Yeah.
This guy won it twice.
He never did?
No. Yeah. I mean, he won the WEC belt.
That was his...
Dominic Cruz is his kryptonite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, first time I ever watched Dominic Cruz fight, I was just like, oh my God.
I sat on the couch and fucking passed out. Just, he doesn't stop moving. I always refer to him as like a fucking squirrel on crack. He's just like all over the place.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
And it's the point which made it even more amazing. My first time watching him, it's left leg forward, right leg forward, up, down, change level, this side, that you can't track him. It's just like you don't know where it's going to come from, but it's going to come. You know, it's amazing. He's one of my favorite fighters.
He'd be happy to hear that.
Well, it's just because of the uniqueness that he brought. He brought an element to fighting that, like, it's not the stand-up and, you know.
He's just so smart. You talked to that guy. He's an encyclopedia. I mean, he knows. All he's doing is studying fighting, that dude.
It's incredible. And part of that's like Mike Tyson, what made him great. He was a student. He was a student, man. He'd go back and watch old films and, you know, take a look at it and see where the heritage of what he's doing comes from. So
yeah, exactly.
It's big.
Well, listen, Mark, it was such an honor to have you on, man. I if you would have told me, and Josh, back in the day, hey, listen, I'd be talking to Josh Barnett and Mark Kerr. I mean, who the
you'd
fuck
go,
am
what
I?
What the fuck happened to my life?
No,
that's what you'd be saying, like,
no
Jesus
way.
Christ.
No, you know what I'd be saying? Whose dick did I have to suck?
Yeah, exactly. Sheik in Abu Dhabi.
No.
Oh, thanks, man. I appreciate that. Well, listen, you could see me, guys. I'm doing comedy July 3rd to the 9th in Las Vegas, UFC Fight Week. If you want to come to a show, Mark, where are you going to be?
I'm going to be here actually for the next 3 days, and then I'll keep you posted. I'll be doing some seminars, and I'll give you that info. You can pass it along.
Now, why do you have no Twitter account, no Instagram?
No, man, I'm like, you know what? I'm not quite a millennial. I'm kind of that
fuck millennial. You need people want to you people. You would be surprised. Kevin Randleman, like the week before he died, I came out. I did a Periscope with him where fans were asking him questions, and he couldn't believe it, you know. And I think a lot of the old timers, they don't realize the impact.
I could only see Kevin Randleman tweeting in all caps.
He's like, oh my god, I could do this like from home. I think a lot of times
that also would have been highly entertaining to see Kev. Tweeting. Oh, because the interviews he would give sometimes, I go, Coleman, man, what the? He just look at me and go,
shake his head.
Man, I don't know, man. It's just Kev. It's just Kev, you know, fuck.
But Mark, I honestly really think that you'd be surprised. And like when I said I'm going to have Mark Kerr on the podcast, I got flooded with people going, Smash Machine, holy shit. Sean McCorkle said, you know, a guy who beat Mark Hunt in under a minute said, you're the reason he got into fighting.
Wow.
All these people were saying they couldn't believe it. And I honestly think that sometimes, you know, you're sitting there, you're kind of in your own bubble, but you don't realize how many people you've actually affected and touched. So I would have, that's the one thing where social media, aside people telling you that you suck and shit.
I know how many people I've touched. That's actually been kind of part of my problem. My issues with the law has been about, you know, how many people I've touched and perhaps where I've touched them.
Yes, of course,
so,
Josh.
You know, nonetheless, I'm still on social media.
But please, man.
I think this is encouragement, this whole thing out here, talking to Sean, talking to Alex, and, you know, just a couple other coincidental things that it's going to give me the push I needed to really.
You should.
I,
honestly,
engage.
Like, I have 68,000 followers on Twitter. So if you, first day you start up, okay, I will say, guys, this is really Mark Kerr. Yeah. You'll at least have 7 followers by the end of the day. Josh, what do you have coming up?
I am calling, we'll be doing, me and JR will be doing Dominion on the 27th. So I'm hoping that'll push out by Friday. So we're calling that New Japan action, Kenny Omega and Kazuchika Okada 2, which I know people are pretty hot to see. But leading off from that, July 1st and 2nd in Long Beach, me and Jim Ross will be calling the action live for New Japan Pro Wrestling in their first ever mainland America professional wrestling show. It's been sold out in 5 minutes both days, and so that's going to be fantastic. I may have a couple seminars coming up here, one in Orange County, one in BC. In August, I will have dates on that on my social media, which is at Josh L. Barnett on Twitter and on Instagram. Other than that, just doing my classic car stuff, trying to get a few projects off the rack and onto the road. And, you know, every now and again, getting suckered into coming onto this fucking janky-ass podcast.
Thank you, man. No, you're a legend.
Well, although I have to, a big shout-out to Cold Steel Knives and supporting my team and everything that we do, as two of my guys fought just last weekend at CXF in Burbank. AJ Bryant won his fight in the first round by TKO, and Shohei Yamamoto in the first round of the 8-man King of Cali 155-pound tournament took his undefeated fighter out in 22 seconds.
Wow.
With a great counter left hook, and won the interim title at the very same time and moves on to the second round of the tournament. And I've been working with Travis Brown leading into his fight against Alexei Oleinik July 8th.
And how's Travis looking?
Travis is looking great. I'm really glad with a lot of the work he's been doing, and just seeing his growth throughout the process is a really, really fantastic.
Cool. Well, thank you. Thank you for doing the podcast. Kerr, you're a legend.
I appreciate it.
Barnett, you're a legend. And I want to thank our sponsor, Blue Apron,
the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. And Blue Apron achieves this by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. Blue Apron has established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranches across the U.S. And as a result, their seafood is sourced sustainably under standards developed in partnerships with the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch. They have beef, chicken, and pork that come from responsibly raised animals. I'm telling you, Blue Apron can be delivered to 99% of the continental U.S. and 99.5% of food deserts. And because Blue Apron ships the exact same amount of ingredient required for a recipe, they are reducing food waste. Listen, people, cooking together builds strong family bonds. Research shows that Blue Apron families cook nearly 3 times more often. And those who spend a lot at restaurants at high-end grocery chains can now spend under $10 per person for a delicious meal. Listen, this upcoming meals are warm smoked trout and asparagus salad with fingerling potatoes and garlic croutons, spiced zucchini enchiladas with creamy lime and tomato rice, elote-style vegetable tostadas with summer squash, poblano peppers, and cilantro rice, and peach honey glazed chicken with mashed sweet potatoes, collard greens, and Thai basil. Listen, not all ingredients are created equal. Fresh, high-quality ingredients make a real difference, so it's important to know where your food comes from. I'm telling you, me and my girl, we have Blue Apron night. I feel like I'm Emeril Lagasse. I feel like I'm an amazing chef. We have it's romantic, it's sweet, it's delicious. I'm telling you, Blue Apron. Go to blueapron.com/MMA roast and get your first 3 meals free with free delivery service. Go to blueapron.com/MMA roast. It's unbelievable. You got to check out Blue Apron. blueapron.com. I'm telling you, you're going to love it. I will not steer you wrong. I look forward to our meals getting delivered and cooking. And I look forward to eating. And I feel great. And I look better. I'm healthier. I know what I'm eating. Check it out. blueapron.com/MMA roast. And thank you for listening to the podcast.